Next up on This Week in Law, Gus Hurwitz, Alan DeLevy, Sarah Pearson, and I take on the great computer glitch of July 8th, freebooting, Reddit's meltdown, whether Facebook is too polarizing, net neutrality, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Sarah Pearson. Episode 310, recorded July 10th, 2015. Outsourcing Notice to Vogons. Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and thank you so much for joining us for This Week in Law. We're really excited to be back. We were dark last week, but we are back and better than ever. Going to talk about all the most exciting and interesting things to us anyway at the intersection of technology and law, and we've got a great panel of folks here to do that this week, per usual. Joining us once again is Gus Hurwitz. Gus was here with us last in May. And he's a professor at the University of Nebraska School of Law, where his interests and studies involve law and technology and economics, innovation, competition. Great to have you back, Gus.
It's great to be back. And it looks like all the things we were talking about in May, they're still here.
I know, they are. And we wanted to have you back again real quickly after your last visit, because we did not at all get the chance when you were here with us last to really do a deep dive on the telecommunications issues that you are well-versed in. So we definitely will get to that today. And if not, someone can come and kick me for being a bad host. Also joining us is Alan DeLevy. Alan, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Close. DeLevy.
DeLevy, there we go. Alan is with DC Legal Hackers. He is a co-founder of DC Legal Hackers. He's also an innovation specialist at 18F, which is a digital services team within the U.S. federal government. Can you tell us a little bit about 18F, or would you have to shoot us?
No, I'd absolutely love to tell you all about it. So first off, nothing I say here represents the views of 18F. I'm just here speaking for myself. Right. But 18F is a digital consultancy within the General Services Administration. So we follow a consulting model where we work for clients, which are other partner agencies, delivering mostly websites for other federal agencies.
Wonderful. It's great to have you with us, Alan. Also joining us is my co-host, Sarah Pearson, Senior Counsel with Creative Commons. Great to see you again, Sarah.
Hey, Denise. Great to see you, too.
All right. Let's dive into it. There's been some interesting stuff going on this week. Particularly Wednesday seemed to be a dark day for various people's online activities. And we think that maybe some of this has to do with crimes and justice. So let's start there. All right. The great glitch of July 8th, as one of the articles in our discussion points characterizes Wednesday's activities, when the New York Stock Exchange went down, United Airlines had to ground, I think, all of its domestic flights. The Wall Street Journal went down. Gus, what do you think went on here, and should we be concerned?
So the amazing thing that it looks like happened is a number of completely independent events. It appears that what happened with United Airlines was a router that went on the fritz and just had to be reset. What happened, press reports today are saying, with the New York Stock Exchange was the result of a software update that they rolled out. And I haven't heard what happened with the Wall Street Journal, but it seems like it was a independent thing that happened. So should we be concerned? None of these seem to have been the result of malicious accidents or malicious actors. They don't seem to have been related, which to me says, yeah, we should be concerned if a number of independent things can all go wrong in a single day on this scale. I almost would prefer it if there were some one bogeyman bad actor that we could say, hey, this was the result of some person taking a single deliberate act. Here, it was just happenstance. And it really goes to show how reliant we are on these systems and how really complicated these systems are to set up and maintain.
Right. So, I mean, it is a little bit even more scary than if there were bad actors that you could point a finger at for all of these events, because at least in that instance, folks like us and lawmakers could do some planning, do some proactive steps, have some laws and regulations on the books that would try and prevent similar events from taking place in the future. But when we're talking about pure happenstance, stuff happens, technology glitches, how are we supposed to deal with that from a law and policy standpoint, do you think?
So to me, the interesting question isn't how are we supposed to resolve it or deal with it, but why haven't we resolved it or dealt with it? The last several years, every single year, we've called the year of the cyber attack. So 2009, 2010, 2011, every year has been worse than the previous year. And this year, I think, is going to again be the year of the cyber attack. Next year might not be. Next year might be the year where we start to instead focus on what we need to do to improve the resilience of the infrastructure, both to attacks and non-attack incidents. So why are we in this situation? I place the blame is too strong a word, but I'm going to use it. I place the blame largely on the systems themselves, poorly designed software. Now, I don't like to say I'm placing the blame there or even to use the word designed software, because it is really, really, really hard to design software that is not subject to these sort of flaws. That's part of why in our legal system, it's very difficult to establish liability for software defects. We need to find ways, I think, to change that model where we do need to have some form of liability for either defective software or failure to implement potentially defective software in a way that's more resilient to these attacks. And I've started to hear a lot of people, and this is a direction that my own work is going, starting to think about how we can do that, whether or not we can do that. One interesting topic is in the design of software, should we be assuming failure modes, both in the design of the software and also the implementation of that software in various systems? Should we assume that a hack is going to happen? If you are, let's say, hypothetically, in the federal government working for OPM and you're designing their systems, should you try and design a system that is rock solid and cannot be infiltrated? No. Because you know the system can be infiltrated, so you should have multiple rings around the city so that multiple bad events need to happen simultaneously in order for a breach to occur. So that's about how you effectively implement the system, assuming that the software is defective, and you've got the question then about also better software design practices.
Alan, I'm assuming these issues are very near and dear to your heart. Do you agree with Gus?
Yes, I think assuming failure at nearly every level will help you build a better system. I think recently, maybe a few weeks or a few months ago, Google announced they were like doing less corporate intranet and moving everything to like an authentication-based model. So basically, they're assuming that anything on the network itself is unsafe. So even just because you're on Google's corporate intranet doesn't mean you should get access to anything that the public can't. I see that in the way that, you know, we develop software at work. I mean, the first thing we do is we write everything open source. And that's like a new thing in government, fairly new. And security shops every now and again will take issue with that. They'll assume, you know, just because someone can see, your code, that your software system is less safe. So just by starting with an assumption that, yes, everyone on Earth can see your code, how do we still build a safe thing? You're probably going to build a better, more resilient, and safer system.
All right. Are you confident that people are paying enough attention to these issues? Do we need, aside from good people like you, helping build stronger systems? Do we need incentives from the government in the way of laws and regulations that will ensure that certain baselines are met, certain compliance is made?
Sure. So that's interesting. So, I mean, we already have some of that with like PCI compliance, which are regulations relating to the security of storing credit cards. And, you know, on one hand, you can think, oh, regulations, they're very onerous. There's a high cost to comply with them. But I'd say in the specific example of PCI compliance, the market has responded incredibly well with, you know, companies like Stripe.com, which sort of sell themselves and market themselves as, we will handle the PCI compliance for you, and you never have to store a credit card on your server, and you never need to even deal with this compliance. So maybe that type of model in other areas can work. And I guess I'm also interested in maybe what Gus has to say about different liability models. Maybe we could see the development of mature insurance markets for cybersecurity. I think all of that can help.
What do you think, Gus?
Really fascinating and very, very complicated set of issues here. To start with the question, should there be some level of government regulation here, some level of government-issued baseline standards? I think that there is some role for the government to play, but I think that role should be facilitating better adoption of good standards. And it's both a really complicated problem that I don't think that we should be able to expect, or we should expect the government to be able to address. And the government, I think, has demonstrated that it really can't come up with good standards here. And the reason I say that, if you look at the various types of guidance that you get from different government agencies, you get conflicting guidance from different government agencies. The Federal Trade Commission, for instance, has brought data security breach actions against companies that had sought guidance and complied with guidance from other government agencies. So you have different agencies telling private actors what to do. And in the case of a lot of the breaches that we've seen of government data, you have the government agencies themselves not following the guidance that other government agencies were providing. So it's hard to see whether or not it's hard to trust the government to create these standards, particularly when, and I love pointing this out, a lot of the recent breaches over the last couple of years have been of software or firms that are themselves security related. So the most recent one in the news this past week, Hacking Team got hacked. These are professional hackers. These are professional security experts. You've had certificate authorities that have been hacked over the last couple of years. These are the people who issue SSL certificates. These guys should be the best in the world at cybersecurity and computer security, and they're making mistakes. You had when Lenovo was installing software that allowed intercepts of encrypted traffic earlier this year, or when it was revealed earlier this year, we found out about that because the security firm that had developed that software had used for the password the name of the software. Really bad security practice. It's hard to believe, if the security experts and professionals have trouble doing this stuff right, that the government could do this stuff right. So what do we do? I love the fact that the idea of cyber insurance was, and I should say I agree with everyone out there, the term cyber XYZ is really frustrating. For ease of parlance, I'm going to run with it. But some form of insurance for these breaches and incidents, I think, is a really great idea, and I'm an academic, so I'm going to put in a plug here for my own work. I'm working to develop a project that is trying to find a way to create a workable model of cybersecurity insurance to improve the incentives that firms have to design good software. The challenges when you step away from regulatory approaches is, if you're not looking at regulation, you're looking at private law enforcement. What does private law enforcement mean? This means something goes wrong with my software, so I sue whomever developed the software, or I sue the hacker. That is, I'm bringing a non-government-based lawsuit, typically in tort, against whomever developed that software. Well, as I said a few minutes ago, especially in American law, it's been very difficult to establish liability for those sort of claims, both due to the nature of the product. We say that these aren't products. Typically, they're governed by contract. It's hard to prove any damages. It's hard to prove, if you can prove damages, causation, that they were caused by the defective software itself. So I do think that there's a good argument to be made that the government needs to step in and make it easier to bring private lawsuits against firms developing problematic software or problematically implementing the software. That's the direction my own work is taking, and I expect and I hope that that's a direction that we're going to see the industry moving and the law moving in the next couple of years.
Is it hard now, Gus, for people to bring private lawsuits if someone has made software that included vulnerabilities that has made, for example, their data that was protected under privacy laws freely available or available to parties they didn't want it seen by?
Yeah, it's almost impossible to bring that sort of suit. There are a number of reasons for this. The simplest is, most often when you buy software, you're not buying a product. You are licensing the software, which means that the terms of use are governed by contract. Those contracts very typically, almost always, include something that says, we do not guarantee or warrant that this software is not defective or that it's suitable for any purpose. You agree not to hold us liable. And the courts have upheld those sort of restrictions. Even if a court were not to, it's been very difficult to prove what the actual damages are. And very frequently, this software is going to be made available by entities that couldn't, they're so-called judgment-proof entities. It would be difficult to get the damages out of the entity. As one example, we've seen several security flaws over the last 2 years in the OpenSSL library. That's the library that powers most of the encryption that happens online. This is an open source project. Historically, it's been manned by four part-time volunteers. If there's a problem with OpenSSL, how are you going to prove first that a breach based upon circumventing encryption was directly the fault of the OpenSSL library? Second, even if you do, how are four volunteers going to be held liable for any damages? It's a very big challenge.
So I just want to add to that. I mean, just from a policy perspective, you very much don't want those four folks to be the target of something like this. I'd imagine that in a world where companies were facing serious liability for, let's say, failing to implement the latest version of OpenSSL or any new patches, you'd want those companies held liable. And assuming there's a robust cybersecurity insurance market, that could actually lead to maybe better funding models for the types of folks that maintain these open source libraries. There's something just incredibly, incredibly wrong with the fact that such critical software that enables so much of what we do online is really held up by four people, four volunteers. We need to fix that.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. I was going to say that's absolutely the case. And I actually want to go back to something that Alan said at the outset that I think was really very, very important. When he was speaking about the importance of open software, he said that if you have all of your source code in the open, that is going to force you to up to a higher standard. You know that any security vulnerabilities in that software are out there. They're out there for anyone to see. They're not hidden away. So you're going to need to be more careful about protecting that software. What he didn't say, and this is an argument that historically has been made about open source software, Alan didn't say that because the software is out there, you're going to have millions of eyeballs looking at the source code, which is going to find all those security flaws and help to improve the quality of the software. One of the things that we've clearly seen over the last several years is that model does not consistently work. The fact that OpenSSL is open source software didn't mean that there were millions of eyeballs out there finding and fixing all of these different security vulnerabilities. That's a model that really animated a lot of the early open source movement. And I think that it's one that we have recognized our faults with.
So I would never consider that like as a given. Just because you open source something, you have to consider factors, you know, such as, you know, is the thing I'm making a big deal? Is this the type of thing that's going to attract a lot of eyeballs? You know, if I just roll my own blog software and open source that, no one's going to care, and I'm probably not going to get responsible disclosures of vulnerabilities. But that said, I mean, the types of things that the types of vulnerabilities that can be freely disclosed to large players is it's nothing to shake a stick at. And you know, what we're doing at 18F is fairly new. We're easily not the first in government to be using open source, but on a project I was working on just a few months ago, someone posted, hey, you might want to upgrade, you know, your version of Ruby on Rails. It patches like two recently discovered vulnerabilities. And that was someone alerting us to that, and we were able to address it and deal with it within minutes.
Yeah, I'd certainly rather have that than not have it, for sure. It certainly can't hurt to have additional eyeballs. The additional eyeballs may not find every problem, but
sure. And the eyeballs might not even be humans. So one interesting anecdote, one thing that Amazon Web Services does is they will constantly scan GitHub. Are we all familiar with GitHub and AWS?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it'll constantly scan GitHub to see if any of its users' API keys have been checked in to public source code, and it can spot that within seconds and immediately notify their customer that one, that they released their key out in the open, and two, they can immediately disable it. So if I had worked off of a closed source code repository, checked my version control, checked my API keys in, and a hacker got access to that, that hacker could sit on it for months or even years and I wouldn't know about it. But if I did the same exact thing out in the open, Amazon notifies me within a minute, and the problem is addressed and mitigated.
Yep. Hey, can you go back, Alan, to what you mentioned earlier about Google and corporate intranets? Because it was sounding as though you're saying that they are attempting to disconnect them from the public internet entirely. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. In fact, the exact opposite. So they, rather than having this corporate network that they sort of treat as, you know, behind the castle walls and assuming that it's safe, and based off of that assumption, granting access to different resources, they'll assume everywhere along the network, even their internal network, is unsafe. And I think that's just an incredibly, incredibly wise move.
Right. Everyone's a Cylon, in other words.
Yes, yes.
Yes, exactly. Sarah, any thoughts about all this?
No, I'm just sitting here listening and learning. It's fascinating. I think in some ways this kind of topic is always depressing because it starts to feel like it's futile, you know, that there is no perfect security. Gus was talking about how, you know, private security companies are themselves getting hacked. And so sometimes it just feels like, you know, there is no answer. But I certainly think that it's hard to think that the market is going to work it out. On the other hand, so I don't know. It's a really hard problem. Certainly, individuals in trying to enforce these data breaches doesn't seem like a way to solve it either. So it seems to me like there has to be some sort of policy solution. And I liked Alan's idea, or you know, pointing out that we do have successful examples of this with PCI. Which is that? Does that? I should actually clarify. Does that mean credit information? Alan, is that what you're referring to?
I'm not sure. But okay. Yeah, I'm referring to PCI in the credit card context.
Right.
Yeah.
So there are successful
examples. We have just one other story under this topic that we haven't touched on yet, and that has to do, we talked about Hacking Team getting breached and the irony of that and the fact that they've said that now their surveillance tools are sufficiently out there that they could be aggressively used by anybody who wanted to use them, which is sort of scary. So I wanted to bring that up and see if folks have thoughts on that. And also we have not yet talked about Donald Trump and his hotels also being this time not being just a glitch, but apparently a retributive kind of attack targeted because of some really silly things that Donald Trump said. So Gus, you want to bite on either of those?
Oh, the hacking team thing is fascinating for a number of reasons. I don't know that we really want or need to get into too many of them, though. A thing that I will point out, a lot of the exploits that already are being discovered from their material are already being patched. So several of them, there have been news reports that the firms have had already discovered and patched the exploits hacking team had found. Others are now being patches are now being rolled out, or some already have been rolled out. And also a lot of the attacks that are discussed in the hacking team materials apparently relied on unrealistic attack vectors. So how do you breach a encrypted communications channel? Well, let's start by breaching the computer, one of the endpoints. Well, in that case, you're not really breaching the encrypted channel. You're just bypassing it. There is a interesting other aspect of what's going on with hacking team, and I'm going to put to the side all the international law aspects that I think are really fascinating and in a sense troubling, but I don't know that we really want to get into them. But it's worth noting and I think commenting on the nature of a lot of the material that was exposed from hacking team was just personal emails and internal corporate discussion. And it's in many ways a very gossipy sort of story where, oh, look at all this dirty laundry. Exciting. And I think in a sense, even though what Hacking Team did and does as a business model is controversial, it's unfortunate, I think, for us as a community to be really just taking glee in seeing all this dirty laundry exposed.
All right. I think we can all agree it's fun when the Donald gets hacked one way or another. I don't know. I'm not encouraging anyone to do it, but it makes for good news. Good headlines anyway. Let's remind you that all of the stories that we've been discussing are available for you to check out at your leisure at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/310. And also let you know that we occasionally put we try and put two in each show, MCLE passphrases into the show. If you are listening for continuing legal education or other professional education credit, and you need to demonstrate that you actually watched or listened to the show, you're being compelled to demonstrate your compliance, then we give you these passphrases. So you can say, yes, indeed I did. And let's make the first one comb over in honor of the Donald. And then let's switch gears and talk about a copyright story or two. All right. I just love this phrase, freebooting. It reminds me both of Lynyrd Skynyrd and of illicit drug use. And I don't know how the booting comes into it. But it is a phrase that means that a video that has been posted somewhere, say YouTube, by someone who hopes to monetize that video on that platform, has been taken and ripped and stripped of identifying information and then palmed off on another platform as though it was the uploader's very own work. And this is happening more and more with the two players in question. And this is somewhat ironic given that YouTube used to be the copyright bad boy It now, you know, is the place where people will upload their things and know that their takedown process is rapid. And if there are problems with someone ripping and stripping and trying to pass it off on YouTube, it's going to come down pretty quickly. But it's not happening quite so quickly on Facebook. And this is complicated by the fact that Facebook has architected a whole new push for its video platform. It very much wants people to upload videos natively to Facebook rather than simply linking to videos on other sites. You get a much bigger bang for your buck as far as where your video shows up in people's news feeds if you do upload it natively. And there are plenty of people who are engaged in this freebooting process. And apparently Facebook is taking these videos down, but when notified that it needs to do so, but its process may take so long, you know, a couple of days is not that long, but in internet time, it can be a very long time when something has a viral kind of appeal and there are 20 million views in a 48-hour period and then everyone has moved on to something else. So Gus, I'm wondering what you think about this issue of freebooting and liability first on the part of the freebooters themselves, and secondly, on the part of someone like Facebook, who is now in the sights of the copyrights right holders.
Right. So in terms of liability on the part of the users themselves, if you can find who they are, it seems like this is a pretty clear case of the user whose material was stolen and uploaded by a Facebook user. They should be able to bring a suit against that user. Whether or not they will be able to prove damages or find out who that actual user was, or if they're in a jurisdiction where you'll be able to get jurisdiction over that user, that's a harder legal question, but it's a standard sort of legal question. Liability for the platform, for Facebook. Facebook is in compliance, as far as I know, with Section 512 and the relevant safe harbor provisions. They have in place a mechanism for providing notice and takedown of this material. They have in place a mechanism for disabling the accounts of repeat infringers. So it would be hard to establish liability for Facebook. Hard is a generous term for under U.S. law. They almost certainly can't do it. If this were an exam for one of my students, I might take off points for hedging and saying almost certainly couldn't do it. so long as they're in compliance with the safe harbor provisions, it would be hard to recover anything. Interesting question here, in my mind, is could YouTube take action against Facebook? They're possibly not on copyright grounds, but perhaps some interference with business kind of grounds. There might be some claim there. I think it's unlikely, but I expect this is probably a flash in the pan. I expect that YouTube and Facebook are going to find some way to cut a deal where Facebook is able to tie into YouTube's content ID system or something along those lines to identify whether or not a video uploaded by a Facebook user was ripped from YouTube. From YouTube. That seems like the technical approach that should be taken, and I expect the law will find a way to work to that end. Fascinating technical thing going on here, the business and economic thing going on here, is just how fast these videos are spreading. When you have 18 million views in a two-day period, that moves far faster than any legal mechanism or any ex post that is after the fact legal mechanism is going to be able to accommodate. So we need to have some sort of ex ante or before the fact mechanism in place in order to prevent these harms from occurring, or some very strong liability mechanism in place to deter them.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue, and I hadn't really thought about YouTube possibly getting involved to protect its users in this situation. And I think that's a really good point, that it's something that could be on the table.
They're not necessarily protecting their users. What's YouTube's interest? Okay, we can be generous. And Google, they do care about their users. They're a friendly, happy company. At least in 2000, they were. Sorry, Google. But their real thing that they want to protect is their own business interests. Users aren't able to control their videos on YouTube, then users are going to start moving to Facebook's video platform in even greater numbers. And if YouTube is losing 18 million views in 2 days worth of ad revenue, they really care about this. So they have a big interest in finding a way to address this.
So can I jump in quickly?
Yes, please do.
I kind of find this story amusing because to me it seems like the same old piracy story, but with new players from the kind of the new digital economy. But, you know, it's just a matter of it's just copyright infringement moving from platform to platform. I think two things. One, I think it's inevitable that Facebook is going to come up with some sort of content ID of their own, or Gus might be right that they're going to cut a deal with YouTube because YouTube has a very strong commercial interest in keeping people on their platform. And that's kind of been part of their design. They wanted people to use the embeddable player rather than downloading the videos. I don't think they have a download function at all. Obviously, people have figured out a way to do it, but it's not, you know, formally authorized by YouTube. I think in their terms of service, they say that you can't share the videos in any way other than the functionality that they distribute. So they're trying very hard to keep people on their platform because they have a commercial interest in that, and that's part of their business model. The other thing I was thinking is, you know, this, no matter, you know, they've tried all of these things to keep people on their platform. People have figured out a way around it. That's just an inevitability. If it's not Facebook, it's going to be some other platform. And so to me, the interesting thing is, you know, creators that are surviving and kind of tying their ship to YouTube, are they going to start thinking about ways that they can make money off of having their content on different platforms and not just focusing solely on YouTube revenue? And that's probably, that's going to be interesting to see. And that would be my prediction, is the people that are going to be successful are the ones that are going to kind of adapt to this new reality. I don't think that it's going to stop. I mean, I do think that if Facebook creates some sort of content ID system, it will probably help the problem a little bit. But as with all kinds of piracy, it's just in kind of a cost of doing business as a creator these days.
It's worth noting. Go ahead, Alan.
You raised thoughts with all of us. Go ahead, Alan.
So just this area is very, very far from my expertise. But one thing that interests me is how we're going to have software actually enforcing these. So if you're Facebook, if you're YouTube, there's no way you can rely completely on humans to vet and detect these things. So I'd imagine that anything that they build to detect piracy is going to be overeager and probably scoop up way more than it should. And I would love if this happened, but I don't think like Facebook or YouTube would ever develop a tool that detects if a use falls under fair use. Like that's probably never going to happen. It's right. Just such a like nuanced thing. And I can just see a lot of folks legitimately making unauthorized copies of different videos or different sounds, just getting swept up in the mix.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's it. The constant fight of copyright in the digital domain. And the structure of the law with notice and takedown is you have notice and takedown, then you have counter notice. So the goal is marginal improvement. It isn't to say that we're going to get it absolutely right on one side or the other, because we know that we can't. So we're going to try and develop a law that puts some burden on the platforms to facilitate copyright owners having their content taken down. The original approach was very reliant on the copyright owners to provide notice, and it was very labor intensive. And YouTube now has the content ID system. And one of the other articles that we've looked at for this week talks about a over-aggressive use of that content ID system. And it's worth noting, Facebook is developing a similar system to automatically identify copyrighted materials. You bounce the ping pong ball back and forth. And the way this system works now is it's getting automatically by potentially infringing materials, and that is over-inclusive and also somewhat under-inclusive. You then provide a notice to the accused infringer, and they have a chance to file a counter notice. That's a manual process, but each incremental back and forth, each bounce of the ping pong ball should be dealing with a much smaller number of cases, but filtering it into a more labor-intensive set of inquiries, such as whether or not this is fair use. And in fact, in the, I guess we haven't spoken about the other article that we looked at for today, the case of America the Beautiful, I forget the song, being claimed, identified as a copyrighted material. In that case, it was resolved in a matter of hours. So it was a automatically identified bit of over-inclusion, but the manual system ended up addressing the problem relatively quickly.
Right. Let's bring people up to speed on that if they didn't see it over the 4th of July holiday in the U.S. It was an interesting post from the blog Adafruit where they put up a video of an Arduino rotating in front of the American flag with a public domain song, America the Beautiful, by the U.S. Navy Band as the music. Then they got a takedown notice from YouTube from their automated content ID system. The claim was from Rumblefish, which is one of these companies that manages music rights and tries to take down videos when something's flagged on Content ID. So obviously this one was an instance of Content ID being overbroad, but it also seems like it was an instance, as you were saying, Gus, it was resolved within hours and the video actually was never taken down. Poor Adafruit did have to go through some hassle of demonstrating, you know, yes, we did the right thing here. We used something public domain and they filed a counter notice, etc. And certainly I'm sure they would rather have just gone forward and not have had to make justifications for having done something perfectly legal. But at the same time, the video never did come down. And aside from a bit of administrative headache on Adafruit's part, they were never, you know, goodness knows they weren't sued or had any other adverse outcome here. That administrative headache could get pretty bad, and you shouldn't necessarily have to justify every time you've done something legally. How do you think the balance worked here, Sarah?
I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, it did happen. It all got resolved within a few hours. But I wonder how many of these instances fly under the radar because, you know, immediately, you know, they had EFF tweeting about it. It was all over my Twitter feed. These, you know, the players here kind of knew of the channels to go to make something happen quickly. And so it just makes me wonder. I think there are probably millions of these that we just don't ever hear about that just get taken down quietly and nobody would even know who to contact or that they actually had a right to do it. So I tend to think that to err on the side of Content ID is overbroad, and it makes sense. It's within, you know, YouTube has the incentive to be overbroad because of the DMCA. So it takes the rare player like the Wikimedia Foundation who does actually pretty actively look at, I can't even fathom how many they get, and I don't know what their system is, but I know that they do a really aggressive job of not just automatically taking down when they get a DMCA notice and considering limitations and exceptions to copyright and things. But I don't think that they probably are almost unique in that situation because there just isn't that incentive from a legal standpoint, which is unfortunate. And I don't know the answer, but
Getting back to this freebooting phenomenon and the fact Gus speculates, or maybe you've actually read about it, Gus, that Facebook is developing its own Content ID system. I wonder, you know, when you're talking about things like very publicly protected and widely known works like music and movies, popular music and movies, not independent works, how that translates into coming up with a content ID system that would work for this freebooting situation where you're dealing with the most indie of indies, right? The independent video producer making maybe a little money, maybe considerable money if you look at how some of the Minecraft YouTubers are doing, for example, off their independent, fairly non-professional works. Is it any more difficult to create a content ID system, you think, when there's no large database of, you know, every record ever produced by Columbia? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I think that is a very fair concern. So a couple of points here. First, to close the loop on the Facebook content ID thing, I think that I saw that in one of the articles that they have or are developing a similar system. Mm-hmm. But you're exactly right. That system is going to focus on the big commercial works. So the question then becomes, how do you deal with all these independent content, the sort of material that goes viral? There are a number of possible technical ways that this could be done. Facebook, for instance, could set it up so that if a video starts to go viral, once you hit 100,000 views, that could trigger some manual intervention where a query goes over to YouTube and they look. They could even do that manually, I expect, for the right threshold of the number of views to see whether or not the content was recently put on another popular social media platform. So there are a couple of different ways that could be implemented, and I'm certain there are smart technologists who can come up with even more sophisticated ways. But this is the history and the story of technology. Technology enables new problems, new ways to circumvent the prior legal regime, and then the law plays catch up. And very frequently, the law imposes two draconian responses, and then technology catches up to find a way to soften those responses. And it's a constant back and forth. And the thing to remember about the law is it's not trying to get us to the perfect. We're not trying to solve all the world's problems. We can't do that. We're trying to make incremental steps to making things marginally and incrementally better, always trying to improve what the second best is, because we know we're not going to ever get to the best.
Yep, that's an excellent point. And it's something I think that people lose sight of and have expectations that are not in line with what is actually possible with the legal system that we have. Let us move on and talk about what's been going on the social web. We already are. We're talking about Facebook a bit, but let's talk about some other social players. So all hell has been breaking loose at Reddit. I thought I'd just toss it out there and get people's thoughts. Alan, have you been paying attention to this?
A little bit. I probably stopped looking at most of Reddit like probably a couple of years ago. So maybe Gus is better. Someone else can have more insight.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, if you're you know, the real deal, the real geek here, Alan. If you're not paying attention to Reddit, then who is?
I don't know. I mean, like, my impression of it is I don't know. Like, this sort of goes back to some of the Facebook and YouTube stuff we were talking about. Like, these sites like play a huge part in a lot of folks' lives, and they're like they're very important. They're very significant. You have volunteers on Reddit putting in many, many hours, their blood, sweat, and tears, and then it's ultimately managed by a corporate entity. There's no law on Reddit, and it's just sort of interesting seeing how all that plays out, where people sort of feel like they have a right to something, where maybe sort of in a moral, ethical way they do, but in a legal way they have no right. You know, you don't have any right to have the person who conducts ask me anything's on Reddit.
I love this story because it demonstrates something very important about the social media world and the nature in many ways of the online world, the sharing economy, a lot of the sorts of interaction that have come to define in a very aspirational way what can be done online and how the online world is changing the offline world. And I'm actually going to do something a bit odd in a moment. I'm going to turn around and pull a couple of books off my bookshelf because I think I have them. Yes, right here. Two books I strongly recommend to folks. Robert Elkinson's Order Without Law and Elinor Ostrom's Nobel Prize-winning economist, Governing the Commons. These two books are really fundamental in this area of legal and economic study. What they look at is how societies and how groups of individuals organize their conduct and organize their interactions outside of legal rules. So if you don't have legal rules in place, if you don't have enforceable contracts, you don't have a system where if your cattle run off of your land and come onto my land and destroy my fence and eat my grass, if you don't have legal rules in place where I can easily sue you, how do we get along? And a couple of important conclusions follow from this area of research. A couple of the important requirements for these systems to work is the participants in these groups generally need to have shared or common values. So they need to have a shared view of what the purpose is, what is acceptable conduct or what isn't acceptable conduct, or an agreement to be mutually bound by some arbiter within the system when something goes wrong. You also need to be in a system where people can't take their ball and go home if they don't like the outcome. So you need to agree to be bound by that non-legal arbiter. And what we saw in Reddit with the Reddit situation over the last several days is you had some actor who was violating the legal norms, the norms of the organization, and they kicked someone out of the system, and a bunch of people said, hey, we don't like this. We're going to take our balls and go home. We're not going to play this game with you unless you change how you're going to work with us. So it was a great example of how these sort of groups coordinate and how behavior is organized when you don't have these background legal rules to rely on, perhaps. And it was also, it's also a very nice demonstration of the limits of these sort of organizations and cooperative efforts. And there's a really important lesson, I think, there to keep in mind as we think about the sharing economy, open source initiatives, lots of the aspirational sort of this is how the internet can reshape how we conduct our society. That will only work to the extent that we all buy into that. When conflicts between the actors and disagreements between the actors start to arise, we generally need to have recourse to some external authority. And that's an emerging challenge that I think we need to be more cognizant about.
With a story we'll talk about a bit later in the show when we get around to talking about Uber, which I hope that we will. And the issue that we're going to talk about there has to do with the status of Uber Central versus the individual drivers and their employee versus independent contractor status. Here in the case of a Reddit situation or Wikimedia, as Sarah was mentioning earlier, where you're really getting unpaid volunteers with ideals at stake that are motivating them to perform actions that the organization is relying on. Is it a get what you pay for kind of situation? I mean, there really is no kind of recourse against somebody who decides they're going to take their ball and go home if you've, you know, architected the site such that that can happen.
Yeah, I think it's really, this seems like such a, I'm not a Reddit person either. I'm just kind of watching from the sidelines. And it's a little sad to me to see somehow the community has just completely lost trust in the platform itself, it seems, or at least a vocal part of the community. And so it's all just kind of falling apart, I think. And it'll be interesting to see whether or not they're able to kind of build that trust back up. And if so, how they do it. Because it really seems like this isn't the first story that we've seen of this type about Reddit. I know a few weeks ago they enacted their, maybe this is all related. They enacted their guidelines about
harassment.
Thank you. You know, and so it just seems like there's been all this boiling up, and there's just been a loss of trust in this community, and it's sad to see, from my perspective.
Yeah, it is, and they've certainly contributed a lot to public knowledge, public discourse with their AMAs. So it would be nice if they were able to get it back together. And I agree with you, Gus. I think it's a really interesting dynamic that changes how businesses are run and how they have to think about, you know, how things are going to get implemented and accomplished when you're not working in a traditional employee model. Any final thoughts on it? Do we still have Gus?
Sorry, I didn't know you were throwing to me. No brilliant final thoughts on it. I think it's a fascinating and in many ways a sad situation. It's interesting. Yeah. I don't know about you, Denise, but I'm also not a Redditor, so we might have four non-Redditors here.
Yes.
But to the extent that I do have familiarity with or make use of Reddit, it has been in the AMA context. There has been a lot of interesting stuff there where I occasionally will jump in and see what's being discussed. So this is one of the more visible and external aspects of Reddit. And I think that Sarah's point about the recent efforts to really change the discourse of the community, both those have been really important efforts. And it's interesting to think about how and whether this situation over the last week could be related to those.
Well, if you never post there, if that makes you a non-Redditor, then I guess I'm a non-Redditor. I'm a lurker. I have, you know, certain topics I follow. I do enjoy the AMAs, but I'm not contributing content to the site or, you know, definitely moderating, et cetera. We've talked about having a Reddit page for the show where it would be great for folks to aggregate and help us out with show prep and guests and stuff. I have just never implemented it. And I don't know that now is necessarily the right time to do it. so it's still on the table. We'll see if we do that. We do use other social platforms to communicate about the show. Google+, which I don't know. We do get some great comments and interaction from the Google+ community and also Facebook. And so we may as well bring up this second article here that I had to discuss under the social web this week. And it's actually an older article. I think you put it in front of me, Sarah, a while ago, and we've never really had the chance to talk about it, but I think it's definitely worth talking about in what's an election season, if not an election year. And it has to do with a study that was performed about the polarizing effect of using Facebook, whether people who use Facebook tend to simply get into their own echo chamber and are not sufficiently exposed to contrary opinions and beliefs and political positions. It was a peer-reviewed study published in the journal Science that involved data scientists at Facebook. And they decided that, you know, obviously they have a horse in the race, but they decided that it's not as insular as people might think, and that people definitely do get exposed to other viewpoints. And they judged this based on what people clicked on and follow, you know, links that were followed, et cetera. Now, the end of the New York Times article makes an excellent point. Specifically, they say a click is not necessarily an endorsement or even a sign of an open mind. It might be just that you are scoping out the other side's opinion, or you're being snarky about the other side, what have you. There's no way of really judging the intent behind the action of taking in an opinion from outside your own field of thought. But I'm just curious what you guys think about all this and if it's important from a sociological and policy standpoint. Sarah?
I think it's very important and fascinating. I'm not sure what to take away from the study. So when it came out, we should note, you know, along the echo chamber line, my Twitter feed is filled with people that are kind of in the, you know, EFF side of the world. And so there was a mm-hmm. lot of criticism in my Facebook feed, or Facebook, Twitter feed, about the study and the limitations of the study. It was a really tiny percentage of the population. It was of the Facebook population. It was only people who had declared their political ideology on Facebook, which is a small, even a, you know, small number even there. So there were a lot of limitations. And then the interesting thing was, even though it was kind of like the whole thrust of the study was, it's not as bad. It's bad, but it's not as bad as you think, which is, mm-hmm. you know, maybe slightly reassuring, but not overly. I think it's really interesting that most people, and I would love to see the numbers on this, but so this is completely anecdotal, but I feel like most people out there don't even know that they don't see everyone's posts that they're friends with, that they, yes. you know, it's actually not very well known, you know, at least once you get outside of kind of the digital circles. So the fact that they don't even know that they're being, manipulated is the wrong word because I don't think it's anything malicious, but that you know, it's not random what shows up. And we have no idea how it gets decided. And there's just this complete lack of transparency about it. And I think it is a little bit scary. On the other hand, I think we tend to live in echo chambers even without digital technology. We skew toward people that agree with us. I think that's just human nature, but I think digital technology is accentuating that. And I think it is. It's something that we should continue to study. I don't know if it spells the end of the world or politics or anything, but I do think it's a concern and it's something I'm really interested in.
Yeah, just anecdotally for me, when I was blogging in any kind of an active way in the early 2000s, I felt like it was very susceptible to being in an echo chamber, but that the fact that there was such a wide-ranging discourse going on between people considering the same topic, that you really would see perspectives that were unique and different from your own, maybe completely contrary to your own, and that it was really educational and rounding out in that way. And I don't, now that I'm not blogging, I don't really feel that way. You know, I love that we do this show and get such a diverse variety of people on the show, and I try not to pull from my own echo chamber all the time when we're booking guests, but I'm sure that there's some effect of that comes in. So I encourage people to be aware of it and to be aware of the point that Sarah raises. I get the feeling that most people who listen to our show are savvy enough to realize that you don't see everything that the people that you are connected to post in your newsfeed. But I don't think the rank and file of Facebook's users do know that. Gus, any thoughts on this?
It's a really fascinating study, and it relates to a number of areas of research and a number of studies in this area. It's not a surprising study to me, and I'll explain why. When you're thinking about the formation of these echo chambers or whether or not you're getting diverse information or information sources are polarizing, you're thinking about how a network is constructed. That is how different nodes in the network form connections. So you need to think about what is it that causes those connections to be formed? What is the metric that the nodes use to decide whether or not to connect? And that's generally going to control the sort of information that gets propagated through the network. So if you're deciding what news network do I want to listen to or watch, you're probably going to be thinking, okay, the options are CNN, NBC, Fox, or NPR or some other. And you're then going to be really focusing on what are the political biases and opting into a network that is based upon your own political biases. What about Facebook? well, most of those connections aren't based upon political views. They're based upon real world relationships going over that have been created over the course of our lives. So it's pretty unlikely, if I'm deciding to friend someone because I knew them in college, that that person shares the same political views as I do. So we should expect more diverse political networks to form in Facebook. And I love the comparison that Sarah makes between Facebook and Twitter. My Twitter feed is the same way. It's far less diverse. And that's because it's formed based upon more professional connections, people doing work in my field. So either these are people that I'm linking to and following because they agree with me or because they don't agree with me. And it's a very binary sort of you're in one camp or the other. Facebook isn't like that at all. So it's a fascinating area of research, very important. And it will be very important to see how this plays out as we're entering into election season and as we approach 2016.
Right. And Alan, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this as someone who works, you know, within the federal government and in Washington, D.C., and just generally whether you think that social media is making us more polarized or less or somewhere in between.
Sure. So, I mean, those are sort of an interesting, like, two dimensions. You know, we have, you know, one person could have a feed with a lot of diverse set of opinions and someone's really in their own echo chamber. But I think another layer to that is like what one person's like echo chamber is another person's safe space. So I've benefited a lot from being on Twitter. I haven't ever had to really like lock down my account or deal with really any amount of harassment. And because I haven't had to deal with any of that, I've been able to like benefit, to the maximum on Twitter. All sorts of cool and interesting connections with interesting people have been made on Twitter, and that's been wonderful. But a lot of being able to be open and receptive to the universe of Twitter users is not often in everyone's individual control. Twitter can be, a scary place out there for a lot of people. There's a lot of privilege that I have that I haven't had to deal with any of that. So I would just like, I don't know if it's like a word of caution or something, but like, it's not just like someone can just choose to like have this strong information diet and then they're set. There's a lot of other factors at play.
Yep. Good point. All right. We promised Gus that we would get into some telecommunications topics, and I think we're going to go there next. All right, Gus, the FCC has been having a busy year. So are the parties who want to challenge the latest version of the open internet rule. Many a lawsuit has been filed, and now we're just sort of waiting for the courts to speak. In the meantime, the FCC is not wasting any time in enforcing its net neutrality rules when it thinks that they need to be enforced. So I just wanted to get, we haven't really visited this topic in a while since we got the final word from the FCC as to what its rules were going to look like. And I wanted you to bring us up to speed and let us know what's going on and how you think this is playing out.
Oh, wow. So do we have 3 or 4 hours that we can talk about this?
Not quite.
So let's start with the idea that the FCC is enforcing the rules already. There are two big things that have happened that have people saying that the FCC is enforcing the rules already, and we should add some nuance to these. The first is the FCC's complaint against AT&T. They have fined AT&T $100 million, which is an incredibly large fine, especially to be brought by the FCC. Historically, over the last since about 2000, the FCC has brought between a couple tens of millions of dollars worth of fines against companies each year. Under Chairman Wheeler, over the last 2 years, that's increased to a couple $100 million. So the FCC has been much more aggressive recently in bringing fines, net neutrality related and generally not net neutrality related. The fine against AT&T did not actually relate to the recently adopted open internet order. It was based upon the transparency rule in the 2010 open internet order. which is also part of the recently enacted one. The same and actually strengthened provisions apply. But this actually stems from concern about AT&T's disclosure of its throttling policies on its wireless network. I personally am not sympathetic to the commission's argument here. AT&T, the basic claim is that AT&T was throttling unlimited sourcing substantial amounts of traffic, and that they did not provide those users with notice sufficient under the 2010 Open Internet Order. AT&T actually provided incredible amounts of notice, posted policies to their website, informed individual users that this was going to happen, informed individual users when they were getting close to this happening, informed individual users after it happened. It's hard to imagine that AT&T could have done anything more to be transparent about what they were doing. Nonetheless, the FCC has taken action here. And this will be challenged in court, and it will be interesting to see what happens. The other big enforcement action that the agency is now considering, interconnection provider has filed a net neutrality claim under the new order with the FCC, arguing that it is not being given favorable interconnection terms with certain ISPs. And it seems pretty likely that the commission is going to reject this claim. The chairman actually has said that he wants to find some claims to reject in order to assuage concerns that the agency is being too aggressive. And the claim that has been filed here is about the most aggressive that can be filed. Basically, a interconnecting ISP is saying, hey, we should be given free interconnection with other ISPs. And that is the thing that everyone who is concerned about net neutrality is concerned about. That's a worst case scenario. So I expect that the commission will look at this and say, no, we're not willing to go there. This is a step way too far. And by the way, Congress, don't worry about what we're doing. See, this demonstrates that we have some restraint.
We got a really funny comment in IRC from Reverb Mike that was going through my head in a less succinct way when we were when you were discussing the notice and the fine that followed to AT&T. Reverb Mike says it's a little like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where notice was posted where no one would ever look. I, as an AT&T customer, I can kind of echo that a bit and counter it a bit. I have one of those grandfathered unlimited data plans, and it would have required, and I know that under the law, we should discuss whether under the law you're required as a customer to go to the website and look for updates to things that you agreed to in the ancient past. But the notices that I received on my phone had to do with we see that you're approaching a certain data usage and you'll be capped if you go over it. Now, when I called them and said, what's going on here? You know, I have an unlimited plan. You're going to cap me. And they said, oh, no. We don't do that. This was right before the fine was announced. So I don't know if they were backpedaling in an attempt to put on a good face for the FCC or what their representatives had been told to tell people. But I coming back to the point of, you know, realistic notice, I guess we could move away from telecommunications law and into contract law to determine that one. But I get the point from you, Gus, that you think AT&T had done all that it could have done and more.
Yeah, the concern is what is the requirement upon the firms to provide notice, and it's not clear. And there's a lot of concern that I'm hearing from firms following what happened with AT&T. what in the world did you expect of us? And in fact, we have the recent Sprint debacle where Sprint was doing the same sort of thing. They had the same throttling plan in place. And following what happened with AT&T, they said, okay, we're not going to do this anymore. And then they announced their new all-in plan. And I don't know if folks have heard about this. I wrote a short piece about this. If you haven't seen, I should have sent this to you. I apologize. The David Beckham commercial where Sprint has David Beckham going to the other three carriers' stores and saying, hey, can I get an unlimited data plan? And they all say, yes, but it's not unlimited. And they say, here are these conditions, and here are these conditions, and here are these conditions. And then he goes to Sprint's store and they say, yeah, we've got a simple all-in unlimited plan. And it sounds great. And then they show the fine print and it says, unlimited streaming video limited to 600 kilobits per second. Well, so Sprint was doing the exact same thing. It was making fun of other people for. They were called out in a very public way for this and have since reversed that policy. And now it's not clear what the financial impact of Sprint is going to be with this new plan. There's a lot of concern in the financial markets that this could be very painful to Sprint's bottom line. But the interesting story here is, why does Sprint want to move to this new model? Well, it was in response to the FCC's rules. They basically said, okay, instead of slowing down the 3% of users who are using the most bandwidth, who are using an order of magnitude more capacity than anyone else, and only doing that at times of network congestion, we're going to preemptively slow down everyone. We're going to cap everyone and limit them. Instead of harming the users who are harming the rest of the network, we're going to protect the network by harming everyone. Well, I'd honestly prefer to live in a world where when that excess capacity is available, it can be used and you're only throttled during periods of peak traffic.
All right. Let's talk about some other FCC concerns not directly related to net neutrality. The FCC has been under pressure to become more transparent, and I'm wondering what you could tell us about that.
So this relates to really, really boring stuff for non-lawyers in many ways. FCC's process for adopting rules was shed, a lot of light was shed on this process during the net neutrality proceeding. And there are a lot of issues here that are getting raised that have been longstanding complaints about process hooks. Now that these are issues before Congress and Congress is taking up due to the net neutrality order, the basic sense of a lot of these concerns is that the FCC, like many administrative agencies, doesn't make its orders public unless it's voted on them. So, and that's pretty standard administrative process. When you're developing rules, you put them out for a notice and comment, you put a draft out there, you solicit comment and feedback, you incorporate that feedback into the final rule that you're going to vote on. And once it's final, you vote on that final thing, and then you release the final thing and explain how you incorporated all the concerns that were expressed during the notice and comment period. A lot of folks are saying, hey, FCC, you should release the draft of the text that you're going to vote on so that we can see what you're voting on before you actually vote. From a legal perspective, that doesn't actually matter because the FCC is still going to vote on that same text. Does it matter if you know what they're voting on? From a legal perspective, no, it's just as binding. There is a transparency concern there. It's somewhat legitimate from a psychological perspective, perhaps. In a democracy, we want to see what our leaders are voting on before it becomes a law. Now, in the FCC's case, there's another aspect that is perhaps more troubling. The FCC generally has what's known as editorial privilege, which means after the vote, the agency reserves the right to continue editing and updating and modifying the thing that they voted on until they're ready to release it. Now, historically, this has been used, or it's meant to be used, to make small corrections. So the FCC rushes up to the last minute to get the thing ready to vote on. You realize, oh, we forgot a comma, or we used a couple of wrong words. We're just going to fix those before releasing it. Very frequently, however, those this process has come to be used to make substantive changes to the rules, to reconcile concerns that different commissioners have over the final product. And when you are making those more substantive changes to the thing that's released after it's been voted on, that raises some more serious concerns.
Got so, it. Thank you for that. Go ahead, Alan.
Sure. So, you know, I totally agree. And I like that Gus pointed out that it's fairly standard that a lot of these orders are not published until they're finally voted on. But what we ended up seeing in this round with the net neutrality stuff was a lot of folks who were clearly upset or disagreed with the substance, pretending that the process was the only issue. Both sides have done this. There have been, you know, Republican-run FCCs where left-wing groups have complained about, you know, secret orders coming out. But I think just one little anecdote showing some of the absurdity with this is I'm pretty sure, you know, Ted Cruz complained about, you know, Obama's secret order ready to come out. And meanwhile, this was the same senator who held up Chairman Wheeler's nomination because Wheeler he needed some sort of assurance that Wheeler was not going to be strong on the open political file rule for broadcasters, which is a huge transparency win. If we want to come up with some type of, you know, federal government-wide new norm for how these orders are published, that's fine. What I ended up seeing here was a lot of, like, procedure sniping.
So I'm not sure that I need to say this, but I should say that I am talking to a lot of the groups who are opposing the order. I'm not a named party in any of the challenges, but I'm talking to these folks and helping develop a lot of the legal arguments. And I'm going to both agree and disagree with Alan. There are a lot of procedural claims that are being brought against the order. And in a sense, I think that's unfortunate. I am myself a procedure hawk. I think that procedure really matters. And there are real problems with the FCC procedure that I would like to see addressed. And there were, I think, legitimate notice concerns with how we went from the NPRM to the final rule. I personally would not be happy if the rule ultimately loses on those grounds, because that just slows things down and doesn't really help move this process along. There are other substantive problems with the order, reasons that it doesn't seem to be as good for consumers as it has been billed as being. And there are also important questions about the FCC's legal authority, which is another really boring set of issues, but from a legal perspective, really, really important. I am in part an administrative law scholar, so I care about them a great deal. We didn't talk, Denise, about the other aspect of the San Francisco Chronicle article or the op-ed that you posted or that you put up on the screen. I want to make sure that we do get to that. Is this a good time for that?
Take us there.
So it's a really fascinating article. This is by Representative Eshoo, and she's talking about the importance of the government being able to enact net neutrality regulation, and expresses concern that voters will become disillusioned with government if the government proves unable to step in and enact these rules. It's a remarkable editorial because it is so honest. What the subtext there is, in my mind, when I read the article, is, hey, people are going to lose faith in the government if the government doesn't do this thing that it is telling people that we need to do. It is a very clear demonstration of the political basis of the net neutrality order. And if you go back and look at the timing, and this really makes me very sad. If you go back and look at the timing of the president's decision to get involved in this process, President Obama in November issued a YouTube video calling on Chairman Wheeler of the FCC to adopt a Title II-based approach to dealing with the open internet. He did this immediately after the midterm losses. And as we are transitioning the midterm losses for the Democrats, and as we are transitioning into the election season. And when you speak to a lot of the political strategists here, they view net neutrality as a political football. They view net neutrality as something that the tech community is very concerned about for political reasons that politicians can use to convince the tech literate community that they get them and that they understand and that they're concerned about them. For the politicians, this is 10 million votes. That's what net neutrality is about. And it makes me really sad, but I've been working on these issues since at least 2007. And as we have approached the election cycle, it's been really frustrating and sad for me to see how this topic has been addressed.
So, I mean, it wasn't always 10 million votes, though. I mean, for a while, there was a whole lot of Democratic Congress people who signed a pro-net neutrality letter and got wiped out in 2010. This wasn't always a political winner, and if the tides have shifted towards that, I don't think that means it's a bad issue.
The question is why and how have the tides shifted? They have not shifted based upon the substance of the issue. They have shifted going back to the 1990s, the old Microsoft tactic, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. The political tides have shifted based upon fear, uncertainty, and doubt, where masses have been concerned, convinced that this is an important issue based upon a very superficial understanding that doesn't get into the underlying economics, based upon very legitimate fears, but not based upon a good approach to addressing those fears.
Right. I think that's the problem with this whole issue and the reason that we continue bringing it up and having disparate viewpoints address it on the show is that it's incredibly complicated. It is not something that can be distilled down into a YouTube video, cleverly produced and making a basically political point. It's something that involves economics and involves the way that our economy goes forward, either in a healthy way or an unhealthy way. It involves innovation on both sides of the debate, and I don't pretend to have any of the answers, and I don't necessarily pretend to understand the economics in any kind of a way like someone like you can, Gus. But the sadness about the issue to me is the way that it has been turned into a political football and tried to be reduced to sound bites that, you know, people think that they can get their head around. I don't think it's an issue that's capable of getting your head around without a whole lot of study and concerted effort, which leaves the public in a really awkward and awful situation because they really have no choice but to, you know, look to those sound bites and look to the summaries that they get from people and decide who they trust and who they believe. And, you know, maybe the public's role in this should be made lesser than it has been. Alan, what do you think?
Sure. So, I mean, if a more like middle of the road approach for net neutrality or more policy making by compromise approach is the value we want, I think it's worth looking back, you know, the last 10 years or so on this issue, when this was sort of a brand new issue being brought up, and the folks opposed to it were meeting the proponents with just outright derision. I remember the then CEO of Verizon accused Google of stealing their free lunch. There were all sorts of actual real incidents of ISPs blocking content that they, you know, from a net neutrality value-based perspective, they should not be blocking. And we were seeing a lot of demagoguery coming from the opposition on this. So as soon as this was even brought up as a policy proposal, it was being demagogued. So then fast forward a few years later to 2010, we have the 2010 rules, which have since been more or less endorsed by Verizon, actually challenged by Verizon, and Verizon won, and they got those rules tossed out. And I would say, looking back, that was probably the greatest moment of empowerment to sort of the free press crowd, the further left, more solidly left crowd on telecommunications policy. Had those 2010 rules been in effect and not tossed out by the courts, those groups probably would not have been able to fundraise and collect signatures and send petitions to the FCC the way they did. So in a strange way, it was very much this like Pyrrhic victory for Verizon getting those rules knocked out.
Hey, Sarah, I want to let you weigh in on this because I know you need to run, and then we'll get your last comments on this or anything else we've discussed, and then we'll wrap the show.
Okay. I think a couple things. One, I've always felt like net neutrality was something that no matter how many articles I read, I don't feel completely confident to, for example, have an argument with Gus, who has a different perspective on net neutrality than almost, you know, a lot of the people that I consider my colleagues. So I completely understand this. We've oversimplified the issue. I guess I am not, though, sympathetic to this argument that this issue is somehow more problematic in the way that it's been enacted, because to me, the alternative, so popular sentiment ended up becoming part of it. But the alternative to that is lobbying groups, you know, particular in the telecommunications industries are the ones that are the sole players. I have a hard time feeling like the fact that the public has some idea what's going on, and even though it's reduced to sound bites, which I think is inevitable in our political discourse, I have a hard time seeing that as a negative thing. Although I guess I do wish more people kind of addressed their lack of knowledge. Like I'm open about the fact that I don't fully understand it. I think I still kind of erred on the side of, you know, being happy about the net neutrality order just because of, you know, so many people that I respect thought it was right, and I've read about it and it makes sense, but I still never kind of felt that completely, you know, 100% like I fully understood the issue. But I don't know. I guess I have a hard time seeing that this is a particularly malicious or bad outcome. But I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, the courts have been grappling with it for years and are going to grapple with it some more, and that's where we're ultimately going to have it come down. I think the principles behind net neutrality are good ones. I think the principles of an open and competitive marketplace are good ones. And that there has to be a balance there that makes economic sense. So we definitely... Go ahead, Gus.
If I can just jump in, and I apologize that I'm speaking about this in very broad and general terms. I wish that we could get into a lot more of the nitty gritty, but I just want to quickly respond to the concern that Sarah gives us, which is a very good one. Mm-hmm. In this industry, though, it's not just the ISPs against the FCC. It's the ISPs against the content side. So as we've seen in the net neutrality debate, we don't just have the ISPs on one side and no one except the advocacy groups on the other. We've got the Googles and Netflixes of the world. Those are not small players. In fact, arguably, Netflix won the net neutrality debate. There's a fascinating history here, a really fascinating history. I like to go back to the Telegraph, in fact, with this between, and you can go back further. You can go back to the printing press, if not earlier, between the content producers and the content distributors. And the history of society in this fight has always been, we don't like the distributors. They're mere middlemen. And we love the content side because they're giving us stuff that we like. And hey, you know, we think that these middlemen, they're messing with the distribution of this content that we love. And time and again throughout history, when we've gone and investigated this, we found that it's actually the media side, the content side, that is pulling the strings. And they're using this bilateral bargaining situation where you've got the two sides bargaining over how to get content to the consumers. They're using the consumer there as a bargaining chip. So we see this today in blackouts over content. So you've got retransmission negotiations, your local broadcasters negotiating with the content owner. Well, the content owner knows that if they take their television channel off the air, you're going to call up your cable company and blame your cable company. You're not going to blame the content owner because it's the cable company who you expect to give you the content. If you go back to the late 1800s, the U.S. government spent about 20 years investigating the telegraph companies for manipulating and interfering with the distribution of news via telegraph. And what ultimately happened after dozens of lawsuits and congressional inquiries is it was discovered the Associated Press and INS, they were the ones who were coordinating in order to take advantage of the system and get a better bargaining position against the telegraph companies. So this is a very common dynamic. And the real frustrating thing for the consumer is we're stuck between the content on the one side and the distribution on the other side. That's a bilateral monopoly, a bilateral negotiation, frequently between monopolists or oligopolists. And we're pawns. And it's painful and frustrating and makes us all very, very sour about how the media industry works.
Yeah.
Sure. So look, more. I mean, anytime, Netflix decides to start discriminating and withholding access based off of, you know, who your ISP is, you know, I'll be right there with you in saying that that's horrible. But the problem that we've sort of been facing now, and I think a lot of it's actually been mitigated by the presence of some rules, even though they were, their legal future was obviously shaky. The threat we're facing now is abuse of something close to a terminating monopoly on the part of last mile ISPs. So right now, the power is in, you know, these last mile ISPs. But of course, I think down the road, content is and will continue to become incredibly, incredibly powerful.
Yeah, and I definitely agree that there is a I don't want to say a lack of competition, because there is more competition in the ISP market than most people generally recognize, but there is not enough. That's an area where we really do need more effort. And one of the interesting things in recent years has been the entry of Google Fiber, which has really demonstrated two things, one of which has been economic conventional wisdom and one which has been economic non-conventional wisdom, something that economists have thought unlikely. The first is when the local regulators step down and start cutting red tape and saying, we're going to work with you to facilitate entry and get you into the market. Local entry is possible at a scale and a cost that historically has not been imagined. That's a second point. Historically, it's been viewed as prohibitively expensive for new entrants to enter markets. And Google Fiber has demonstrated that it is possible for commercial entry to occur in these markets. The other area I'm going to put a plug in for one of the areas I think the FCC is really missing the boat. Wireless access, particularly fixed wireless using millimeter wave spectrum, is a potential boon that we've never been able to conceive of for high-speed, low-cost broadband internet access. This is a technology that European countries and especially Asian countries are really starting to explore and develop. They're developing technologies that can do multi-gigabit signals, multi-gigabit connections over multiple kilometer links, even in poor weather conditions. That has the potential to revolutionize the local competition in the internet access market in a way that unfortunately isn't even on the radar screen in the United States. So that's an area where I hope we can see some really positive development and see real growth in competition for broadband internet access.
All right, boys, I think we're going to have to make that the end of our net neutrality discussion. And apologies that we didn't get to talk about Uber and its status as employees, but we are getting toward the end of our allotted time here. We'll have to save that for another show. We also need to say goodbye and thank you to Sarah, because she needs to run. Thank you so much for joining us, Sarah.
Thank you. It was lots of fun. It always goes by too quickly.
Yes, it does. We'll see you next week. We're gonna all three of us stay on and finish up the show, but I wanted to get you out in a timely way. So thank you for everything. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, thanks so much. Bye, everyone.
All right. And I've really appreciated, Alan and Gus, the opportunity to revisit these net neutrality issues in sort of a broad brush way, but with a lot of nuance and consideration for what both sides' goals are, and I think both sides have laudable goals. It's just a question of whether accomplishing them in tandem as possible. And we, as you point out, Gus, what actually the court system is going to determine is permissible under our laws. So that other shoe remains to drop, and we will see what happens as these various lawsuits proceed. We traditionally go out with a resource and a tip for our audience, and I see no reason to break from that tradition. I do think that I forgot to put in a second MCLE passphrase up until now, so I will go ahead and in honor of Reverb Mike's earlier comment, don't panic will be our second passphrase. I think it also fits with our net neutrality discussion. Maybe maybe we should take out the don't and let everyone panic about net neutrality, and also the other topic that we started the show with, the various computer glitches that bring down our systems without even any bad actors involved. But just to make it easy to remember, it'll be don't panic for those who are Hitchhiker's Guide fans. We will give you our tip. Our tip involves robocalls and what to do if you are the erroneous recipient of them. A lawsuit was just resolved in favor of Araceli King in Irving, Texas, who had an issue with Time Warner Cable where they had confused her with another of their customers because she inherited that person's cell phone number. So she was on the receiving end of, I think, many hundreds of robocalls that wound up once various damages were attached. It's the Telephone Consumer Protection Act. It's over 24 years old. It allows for damages of $500 per violation. And because the judge in this case thought that Time Warner had behaved so egregiously in not stopping these hundreds of robocalls, collection action kind of calls that Araceli received, the judge took the step, which he can take under the law, of making those damages triple. So $1,500 per violation amounted to $230,000 in damages. So I guess the tip to be drawn from this is if you are receiving robocalls and you are not the deadbeat in question, don't just sit on your rights. Go ahead and pursue them, because it could wind up being profitable for you. It certainly was for Araceli King. And then our resource of the week is a really, really interesting article that I have not read yet. It looks fascinating, and it's on my summer reading list, and I wanted to put it on yours. It is called Copyright for Literate Robots. It's by Professor James Grimmelman, who folks might remember because he's been with us on the show before. Here's the summary of the article and why you might want to file it away and put it by your nightstand for free reading. Almost by accident, copyright has concluded that copyright law is for humans only. Reading performed by computers doesn't count as infringement. Conceptually, this makes sense. Copyright's ideal of romantic readership involves humans writing for other humans. But in an age when more and more manipulation of copyrighted works is carried out by automated processes, this split between human reading, infringement, and robotic reading, exempt, has odd consequences and creates its own tendencies toward a copyright system in which humans occupy a surprisingly peripheral place. This essay describes the shifts in fair use law that brought us here and reflects on the role of robots in copyright's cosmology. Now, I really wish Sarah were still on the line with us to give us her thoughts on the situation that Professor Grimmelman tees up, since a lot of what Creative Commons does is make copyright agreements between people machine readable. It's a slightly different thing than what Professor Grimmelman has in mind, but an interesting parallel to it. Gus, any thoughts on that?
It's a fascinating article. I suggest those interested in the topic read it. I've only glanced at it, but it's already printed out and sitting on my desk.
Yes. And Alan, from the perspective of someone who makes machine readability possible, do you have any thoughts on that?
Sure. So just very generally, things that are machine readable are great. In the legal industry, in the legal profession, we could be doing a much, much better job with that. So one example is like, don't publish things in PDFs. If you have to publish something in Word, go ahead and do that. One topic I've struggled with is like how to have a machine parse out legal citations. And I know this is like a very like narrow like take on it compared to like how does copyright apply to all text. But as lawyers, we can all be doing better. And I guess I should read that paper. The idea of a copyright cosmology sounds very interesting.
It does, doesn't it? All right. Well, we're going to let you two go as well. And all of you who have stuck with us and listened throughout the show, we really appreciate it. Gus Hurwitz from the University of Nebraska Law School. Wonderful to have you back on the show. Let's do it again. All right.
Absolutely. And I guarantee we'll have lots more time to talk about net neutrality.
Yeah, we will indeed, won't we? And Alan DeLevy from DC Legal Hackers and 18F. Wonderful to meet you. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, if you've been listening along with us live, you've done so at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. That is when we start this show every Friday on the TWiT network. So we encourage you to tune in then if you enjoy interacting with us live or listening along as we record. But don't worry about it if you can't make the live recording of the show. Our whole archive of shows is available at twit.tv/twill. So you should go there if you'd like to delve into some of our recent or distant past. Just if you like to listen on your own time, there are plenty of ways there described where you can access the show not on the website if you want to go to another vehicle for your viewing or listening pleasure. All of the various ways the show is distributed is described there. We love to hear from you between the shows. Please email me. I am Denise at twit.tv. Sarah is Sarah P at twit.tv. And we love hearing your thoughts, your comments, your feedback, your rants, your raves, your suggestions for guests, all of that. Please do get in touch with us either in email or we're available on Twitter. Sarah is S Hinch Pearson on Twitter, and I am D Howell there. I might have gotten her Twitter wrong, so double check that if you're looking her up on Twitter. If you've been watching along during the show, have had her lower third telling you exactly where to find her on Twitter. We have a Facebook and a Google Plus page for the show, as I mentioned. So do get in touch with us in either of those places if you have a bit more to say. We appreciate you joining us, and we will see you next week on This Week in Law. Thank you so much.